This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
March 2019. Join the hard-traveling fanboys as they celebrate Marvel Studios' release of Captain Marvel with Captain Marvel Month.
Coming to you live via tape delay from Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in the L-shaped studio, it's the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, the hard traveling fanboys.
That's us.
I'm Greg Phillips. With me, that voice you hear on the other end of the telecast here, is Nick Duke. Mm-hmm. Nick, how are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I'm coming off the heels of an eventful vacation down to the great state of Mississippi. Papio Daniel Governor. Mm-hmm. And I'm back in full force now and have recovered from my remote report last week. Mm-hmm. And I'm back here in the studio. Nick, you can tell that I'm in the studio because of how clear my voice sounds and how it sounds exactly the same as yours.
Yes. Did you have any success in carrying the fine genre of podcasting to new frontiers, to introducing it to new potential audience members? I heard you had some fun with that, getting to introduce the concept of podcasting to people during your vacation.
Yes. It did come up. The question, what is a podcast, came up a couple times. And so I tried to explain our venture and what it is that we do. And then eventually the question was raised to me, do you get paid for this? Which had a very simple but also quite complex answer, which really boiled down to no. And then it delved into sort of I said, well, but, you know, I sort of have fun with it. It pays me in joy and happy, you know, fun and happiness and time with my friends, which then begged the question, yeah, but what about the money? And I said, well, fuck. Mm-hmm. I didn't say that, but I thought it. But you know what, Nick? We're not in it for the money. I mean, money is good. We would like to have money. If anyone wants to send us any via, you know, PayPal or even the old mail, that would be great. Mm-hmm. But we're not in it for the money. We're in it for our passion for this business.
That's right. You know, it's like JR says, it's always about the two C's, cash and creative. And when the creative is good, you're willing to make some concessions on the cash end. In our case, we're willing to make all the concessions on the cash end.
And also to make concessions on the creative. Mm.
Yes, that as well.
But in any event, yes, my trip went well. I experienced some comic book related media while I was down there in the form of arcade video games. Perhaps I'll delve into that a little bit more later on in the show. And it was a fun time. How's your week been?
It's been okay. I'm not at liberty to discuss the details of that week, of this week.
Yes. In a public setting. You have entered, well, I shan't say anymore. You've entered a unique portion of your civic life.
Yes, that is accurate.
But nonetheless, we're not here to talk about civic lives. We're not here to talk about any of that other stuff. We're here to talk about comic books and comic book related media. And in particular, we're here to continue Captain Marvel Month. And wow, Nick, what timing. We have got a fresh, brand new, exclusive review via Off the Page.
How exclusive is it?
Semi-exclusive review.
Well, technically right, it's not Off the Page. It's a special edition of Hard Travelers for Hire. That's what we're flagging it as.
That's how we're branding it? Okay, yes. Great. Well, let's brand it that way. And let's make it a semi-exclusive Place to Be Nation pop review from our mouths to your ears and maybe other places. I don't know how you listen to your podcast, but
yeah, that's not really for us to say.
Our review of the brand new Marvel Cinematic Universe film, the number one movie in America, Captain Marvel. Nick, are you ready for this?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. We have you and I have discussed the movie already pretty decently offline. And, of course, I've had numerous conversations with people. I've seen the movie twice now, which was a good thing, good opportunity to see how I felt about it, to firm up my feelings about it. So I'm looking forward to discussing it here.
Yes. You've actually seen it twice, once in a group setting and once on your own.
All by myself, all by my lonesome, which, as much as I love my wife, is still my favorite way to see movies, all by myself.
Just like that song from the 80s by that artist.
Mm-hmm, that one.
All by myself. You know that one?
I do know that one, yes.
Yes. Now, do you like watching movies by yourself because you simply like to be able to focus on the movie and the story?
Yes.
Or is it a Pee Wee Herman type situation?
A little bit of both, depending on the film. You know, especially films in the privacy of my own home, it can certainly be the Pee Wee Herman type situation. But typically speaking, I like to be able to just stare at the screen and, you know, not be taken out of it by anything whatsoever. If I had my ideal movie going scenario is like being an extremely rich person and just buying out entire theaters.
Yes.
Where I'm the only person who gets to sit in them, but still getting the theater experience. Yeah, that would be the best thing. But
that would be. But I agree.
You know, we will talk about that. I'm sure both of my theater experiences were somewhat unique for this particular film.
Interesting. Yes, let's delve into that a little bit here in just a few minutes. But I myself saw it with my mother. Down in where were we? I don't remember. Malbus, Alabama, if you're familiar with that area.
I am, unfortunately.
And saw – it's a nice area anyway. Saw a movie theater down there and watched it on Friday. So you saw it Thursday night and you got to see it again on Saturday night. So we really – we should have two different perspectives of this film, given that you saw it twice, I saw it once, but both of us, I think, enjoyed it. So let's get into the film a little bit here. So Captain Marvel, we've established these last few weeks, is a title that passed on in the comics from Mar-Vell to Monica Rambeau and a few other characters, and finally on to Carol Danvers, who is the focus of this movie. She is, for all intents and purposes, Captain Marvel in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The first of this role. She is the Hal Jordan sort of to Mar-Vell's Alan Scott, if you will. And we'll let's just go ahead and confront that head on, Nick. Before we even get into the qualities or lack of qualities or whatever we may find in this film, this was basically, in some ways, a good Green Lantern movie, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, it was. You know, it's crazy because you and I, when we each saw the first Guardians of the Galaxy back in 2013 or 2014, I don't remember when that movie came out at this point. Let's see. Avengers was 12, so Iron Man 3 would have been 2013. So 2014, would have been summer of 2014. Anyway, when we saw Guardians of the Galaxy in 2014, I remember I went and saw it, as I often do, at a Thursday screening. You saw it later that weekend, and we both discussed then, like, my God, Marvel just made a good Green Lantern movie. And at that time, mm-hmm. what we meant by that was not necessarily in terms of direct characterization. Man, easy for me to say. But more so in cosmic setting and not being afraid to lean into that and not being afraid to have an expansive mythos within that. This is more direct. Let me be clear here. I'm not accusing or saying that Marvel was intentionally taking aspects of the Green Lantern mythos and using them to create a successful film. I'm simply saying that it just so happens that some of the elements they chose to use are also elements that are pretty heavily tied to not just Green Lantern, but more specifically the character of Hal Jordan himself.
Right.
In this movie, we get – eventually it is revealed. I mean – there will be some mild spoilers along the way, so bear with us through those. But eventually it is revealed that Captain Marvel, Veers, as she is originally known in the movie, is actually Carol Danvers of Earth, who is a former Air Force pilot who has gone missing after being taken from Earth and inducted into an elite military unit on the Kree planet of Hala. Now, Hal Jordan, you may be aware, is also an Air Force pilot who was inducted into a Galactic Space Force by the Guardians of Oa and sent forth to, again, police the universe. Throughout the history of Hal Jordan, he has come many times into conflict with the Guardians of the Universe, and eventually, in our most beloved and acclaimed Geoff Johns run, separated entirely from the Guardians, realizing that they were actually something that had been holding him back and holding the universe back all along for their own purposes. The Guardians were notorious for telling Hal Jordan that he was too emotional, that his status as an Earthman made him less than his other core members, that Earth, you know, the people of Earth were too emotional, and that the absence of emotion should be the goal for any true Green Lantern. Compare that to the character of Carol Danvers here in this film, who is being led by the Supreme Intelligence and is led to believe by the Supreme Intelligence that the key to unlocking her true potential is simply to overcome suppress her emotions, think with her head instead of her heart. Along the way, she is guided by a mentor who she at first has complete faith in, is even very close friends with, and eventually realizes that he has betrayed her, and they are forced, and she is forced to turn on him and do battle with him near the end of the film, much the same way that Hal Jordan, in more modern incarnations, has had to do the same with his one-time mentor of Sinestro. So there were really
– By the way, wouldn't Jude Law have been a great Sinestro at
still,
some point?
Still would be. I mean, he freaking – the way his chin is pointed, he kind of looks like him. Like, you know,
a little bit. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
What you're looking for in a good Sinestro, I've come to realize in a live-action Sinestro – in terms of physical appearance, is you're looking for somebody who could also conceivably play Beavis in a live-action Beavis and Butthead movie. You're looking for a pointed chin. You want a big forehead that's kind of sloping and angled backward. And then all you got to do at that point is paint him purple and throw some pointy ears on it, and you've got it. So Beavis, Sinestro, Yon Rogg, same thing. But yeah, so there are numerous comparisons there that to be made, and it is – We are not – I think I don't want to speak for you, but I don't think either of us is frustrated by the fact that Marvel, you know, had a character that had some similarities. We're frustrated by the fact that Marvel has once again seemingly seen things and concepts and ideas and executed them to a overwhelmingly successful degree on the big screen that DC does not seem to have an interest in touching on film, and it is – endlessly frustrating to us.
Yes, they pretty much executed Order 616 on the Green Lantern Corps, and I don't begrudge Marvel at all. I think, you know, lots of similarities between lots of characters in both companies, but they just beat them to the punch. They beat them to the punch of showing how you tell this particular story in a much more compelling fashion than what we got in 2000 and 2011, the Green Lantern movie.
Yes, I don't remember.
10 or 11, something like that. But yeah, so anyway, this movie, as you laid it out pretty brilliantly, Carol Danvers and her history. But the wonderful thing about this movie is it kind of – we don't know all this information. It doesn't work like a linear origin story where it starts when she's a young girl and you see her – you know, the classic Richard Donner origin story, right? Where you see the person as a kid, you see them as a teenager, and then you see them as an adult.
Right.
Instead, we kind of pick up the movie in what I actually thought was the weakest part of the movie was the first 15 to 20 minutes where we're in on Hala in the Kree homeworld, and we're just kind of thrown into this situation where she's a Kree member, Veers, and she is going on a mission. Along with her team of compatriots that include a couple of people we've seen before in the MCU, including
Jimon Hansu,
yes, who we saw in Guardians of the Galaxy, and I believe wasn't there another character that we saw here that we had seen elsewhere in the MCU? Oh yes, via a holographic projector, we see Ronan the Accuser pop up.
And then he also appears near the end of the film as well.
Yes. And so it kind of throws us through this sequence that I thought was the weakest part of the movie. Nick, what did you think about the way that this film chose to introduce us? We're not going to go – don't worry, folks. We're not going to go plot point by plot point. But I thought in this case, this was one part of the movie we need to talk about because it's one that kind of I can see why it didn't work so well for a lot of people.
Yeah, so the opening of the film, as you said, opens on Hala. Eventually, she and her Star Force compatriots are given a covert mission to carry out on this planet. They're going to have to go extract a spy. And the Hala stuff wasn't necessarily so bad. I kind of liked the visual image and, you know, showing them how they were going to portray the Supreme Intelligence on film, because the Supreme Intelligence in the comics is kind of vaguely defined and often just looks like a jumbled mass. You know, you can kind of take it in any direction you wanted to. So I liked the whole it displays as whatever, as the thing you most admire or what have you. So that part I was okay with. But really what was kind of subpar to me was that action sequence that was set on whatever planet it was where they were trying to extract the asset from, for a couple of reasons. One, it wasn't very inventive from an action standpoint, but you're certainly far more qualified to talk on that than I am. But my issue is, so when you're doing these types of films that are leaning into the cosmic aspect, every location you visit to me should feel distinct. It should feel vibrant and different than what we have seen before. It should provide a new and interesting visual dynamic. The easy comparison is Star Wars. Like, every world you visit in Star Wars, with the noted exception of Tatooine and Jakku in episodes 4 and 7, which the similarities there were probably intentional, but I digress. Most worlds that you visit in Star Wars feel unique and distinct from one another. They provide a new visual landscape to explore. This planet that we spend 5 to 10 minutes on provided nothing outside of dust and a few rock formations. It was arguably, and this is covering some ground, but I thought it was one of the least inventive set designs I've ever seen in the MCU, which is disappointing because the MCU in general has had outstanding set design, even in some of its lesser regarded films. So this is one of the first times I've ever watched a scene in the MCU and felt like the set design was lazy. And especially in an era where it could have been so much more, but
and perhaps give it something visually distinctive,
right? And perhaps that's a nitpick that should not have weighed the scene down as much as it did. But once you combine that with, like we said, the anticlimactic action, you know, not much there from that standpoint. But
and another aspect of that kind of bugged is like there wasn't much quirk to the personalities of these aliens that we're encountering. Like, for instance, when you watch Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, Drax has quirks based on his race or based on where he's from. Gamora, same way. Rocket, same way. There didn't seem to be many quirks to these particular the Skrulls and the Kree. Like, the Kree basically seem like humans. Mm-hmm. And the Skrulls, very similar. Just with, you know, their Skrull appearance. So I was disappointed in that. But the good news is, and this is like an inverted Green Lantern scenario here, Nick. Is it not? Because
a little bit. Although I was going to say, you know, you mentioned the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie. And you and I, when we talked previously after we both saw the film offline, we talked about how it was a little bit of an inverse Green Lantern movie, where the movie really picked up once they got to Earth. Yeah. I actually liked the bit on the Skrull ship that immediately preceded getting to Earth as well, where she's having to make her escape. I thought that was a fun bit too.
Yes, I thought that was good too. I didn't mind that. It was, you know, it was again. I had the issue with the Skrulls not basically being humans in terms of their personalities and how they behaved.
Which later on in the film, I think they kind of get away from that a little bit.
Yeah, to a degree. Yeah. Yes. I agree. But yeah, so that scene kind of didn't leave me cold necessarily, but I did like it. I thought it could have been a little bit better if they had made the Skrulls, you know, talk and act a little more distinctively, but still fun sequence. Once the movie, though, gets to Earth, it really soars. Mm-hmm. It takes off. And it's funny because with Green Lantern, the best part of that movie is the very small section where they're on Oa,
mm-hmm.
and all the stuff on Earth is, you know, pretty bad. Well, with this, the small section where they're in outer space is kind of ho-hum, but when they get to Earth, it's really good. It the movie really takes off, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure why that is, but I think a big factor in that is the supporting cast that they put in this movie, particularly Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, who gets utilized to arguably the greatest degree that we've seen him in the MCU to this point. You know, maybe the first Avengers movie, I need to rewatch it again. But I mean, Nick Fury is a huge part of this movie, and it really just exposed to me how underutilized he's been in the last few years,
mm-hmm.
because he's great here. And that the chemistry, the unexpected chemistry between Sam Jackson's Nick Fury and Brie Larson's Captain Marvel really carries this movie from beginning to end for me.
Yeah, I would agree. The dynamic, as you said, between the two, the chemistry between the two is outstanding. And also, one thing that we need to note here is we have talked before about how Marvel has kind of perfected the digital de-aging effect that they have used in numerous Phase 3 and even Phase 2, I guess, with Ant-Man films to this point. And I thought this was the best usage of that technique yet, because Nick Fury is relied upon to be on screen a good bulk mm-hmm. of this movie. It is not one cameo and done. He is pretty much in the entire second and third acts of yep. this film. So, outstanding job by Marvel's special effects department on that digital de-aging. The other aspect of this that kind of picks up, and it's one area where I will have to digress. I don't know about you. From our wonderful manager Todd Weber, I thought the '90s references throughout the film were awesome. Added humor to the proceedings, were funny, and were kind of aimed at, you know, our target age range. You know, something for our generation.
Yeah, real quick on the digital de-aging, I thought the Nick Fury was the best that they've done to this point on that. And I thought the Coulson was the worst that they've done to this.
Yes, I would agree
on the digital de-aging, because Coulson actually looked creepy to me once they with the de-aging effects.
A little bit.
He had a little bit of that Uncanny Valley sort of Superman in Justice League kind of look about him, and mm-hmm. he just looked off, I guess, is the best way I could put it. But Nick Fury looked amazing. With regards to the 90s references, I'm kind of on the middle ground on that. I liked the particularly Blockbuster. I loved the cars was a big thing yes. for me. I loved the era accurate cars. The music references I thought were a little heavy handed at times, particularly jumping all across the decade with the music. And yes, you know, hey, it's the 90s. She's wearing flannel and all that stuff. It was a little. At times, it was a little excessive, but again, didn't bother me at all. When I was watching the movie, it never took me out of it. I was having too much fun. Like when I was watching the movie, I wasn't sitting there thinking, okay, enough with the 90s references. I was enjoying the movie so much that I didn't care. But I do agree with the manager that it was a little bit excessive and probably could have been done in a better and more accurate way than it was. But again, fun all around. So I enjoyed the pretty much all the Earth stuff with the 90s references included. Blockbuster being included was fantastic.
Radio Shack.
Could have been done a little bit more. Radio Shack, yes.
The Everybody idea of internet cafes, that was fun.
Yes, yes.
Loading times, dial-up connections, all yep. good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And and again, some of the fashion I thought about during the movie was like, were people really dressing like that in the 90s? Like some of the like group crowd shots of people just looked like people from today. But yeah. Then if you think about it, 90s fashion wasn't, I mean, it was different, but it wasn't
that
as
different.
Wild.
And you have to remember
like
that,
the 80s.
That you and I,
just because there are twists and turns along the way involving classic comic book characters that are done a little bit differently, which one twist in particular, Nick, about a classic Marvel character, I didn't love it like some people did, but I didn't hate it either. It was just kind of, you know, it seemed to me like an unnecessary but ultimately uneventful change that seemed to involve some elements of a character we read about last week, Helen Cobb, right?
Yeah, to me it was kind of combining the character of Helen Cobb with another classic Marvel character. And to me, it kind of was warranted and needed, and I'll tell you why. Because that classic Marvel character has never really been interesting in any incarnation.
That's true.
And so you can sit here and say, well, the only reason they did that is reason X or reason Y. And I will tell you that reason X or reason Y is much more interesting to me than just doing the straight up incarnation of that character. I would rather see more and know more about this version of that character than read practically anything else about the comics version of that character ever again.
Yes.
But perhaps that is my annoyance from encountering that character through Marvel Age that has built up. I don't know.
I don't know. See, I'm kind of, because I didn't find this character particularly interesting either, to be honest with you. Just that she's a mentor character. However, if she would be shown to share more characteristics with Helen Cobbs, I would probably find her more interesting. But that's perhaps to be shown in future movies. However, the other big twist in this movie is kind of subverting audience expectations regarding the villain of the film. And this twist I thought was fantastic. I'm a big fan, Nick, and we've talked about this and gone back and forth on this at times in different movies. Sometimes we're on the same side, sometimes we're not. But I love when the MCU subverts expectations from the comics. I think that for the most part, those changes have been spectacularly good in the MCU. I'm thinking about things like the Mandarin, things like some of the changes they made with Ragnarok, not in particular with Planet Hulk aspect of Ragnarok. So these changes have been for the better in a lot of cases, for me anyway. And this twist in particular, I loved because I didn't see it coming, and it cast this group of characters in a light that is different from what we're familiar with in the comics, from what I've been familiar with on TV and in cartoons. And to me, that's good because I know a lot of people don't have experience with the comics, but I want them to be as different as possible from what we've seen. And quite frankly, I think the argument could be made that the Kree have been portrayed consistently with one characterization in the MCU with almost no exception. And so I want something different from that. And I like what we get in this twist that occurs towards the end of the movie that is showing an alien race that's different and showing establishing something in the audience's mind and then pulling the rug out in a way that doesn't make the audience feel like they've had the rug pulled out.
And it's not to say that there can't later be more classic interpretations of those characters on the big screen, because what I think this does in the case of the characters you're referring to is it provides a level of complexity and nuance that honestly is often missing from the comic book storytelling, where these characters are portrayed one way and only ever one way and don't really have any room for any sort of subtlety about them. It gives you the opportunity to eventually tell stories that are more rooted in the comics, but with this added bit, you're going to have an added complexity and a depth of character and some understanding that not all members of an alien group are potentially feel the same way or act the same way, which makes them a much more realistic example of sentient life, honestly.
Yes.
It does not make them a hive mind, which has often been the case in the comics. So,
and, frankly, makes them inherently more interesting than the Kree to this point, to me anyway.
Well, they were always – I mean, like, that's not anything new. You know, like, those particular characters – and we'll just come out and say it at this point because we've hinted around it so much it's apparent. The Skrulls have always been more interesting than the Kree even in the comics. This is different because it provides a different spin on that dynamic, but they're still more interesting. And I am not – I still believe there are more classically defined Skrull stories yet to come in the MCU – and this will only help to
right.
enhance that when the time comes.
But for the record, Nick, if there aren't, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with the MCU take on the Skrulls.
I think this will be the take on one particular group of Skrulls, but I think part of the story will wind up being, as Carol Danvers has to learn throughout the film, just as there are complexities and not everything can be taken at face value with the Kree, I think the same will eventually be said to be the case for the Skrulls. You know, war is complex, war is dirty, there's no one right or one wrong, I think will be the ultimate
lesson
that she learns
from
this conflict.
That the audience is tired of good guys versus bad guys?
Yes, I am suggesting that.
Oh, well, perhaps we're entering the attitude era of the MCU.
Perhaps.
So let's get on to sort of the cast of this one. We always like to delve into the cast. Brie Larson is the headliner here. She is the story going into this movie. She's been the source of criticism from Sweeten.
That's something else we're going to talk about near the end of the podcast.
Loud groups
half.
On the internet. And here she's playing Carol Danvers, who's a long-rooted comic character. And I thought she did very well, Nate. What about you?
Oh, I thought she was outstanding. Carol Danvers, you know, the thing about every MCU character who is counted upon to lead their own film, and you and I have had our debates about this, but every character is required to provide a level of humor, a level of comedic chops. And I felt like she is probably the driest in terms of humor that they've played any of these characters. Like, oftentimes she is saying things with a straight face, and the only thing that's there to let you know it's a joke is the briefest hint of a smirk at who she's kind of sort of poking fun
at. Tony's kind of like that too, though, isn't he?
Tony's kind of like that, but it is done in such a fashion that, like, the self-satisfied smirk is so... Early Tony had, like, the best shit-eating grins, like, where he just was delighting and reveling at these people.
Yeah.
And hers is much more subdued and subtle. Now, you could also make the argument that the humor just flat-out isn't as funny, so that makes it feel more subdued
which
and subtle.
Which I will make that argument later on in the show.
Yeah, and that's fine, but
that's not on her.
Yeah, I also think that the way she played it was more understated in terms of the comedy than most other lead portrayals have been to this point. And it was something that was interesting because you couldn't just come her – like if you came her have her come out and just act like the female version of Tony Stark, I think it would have rang a little hollow. And as it stands with this
– And is not accurate to who she is.
Right. This feels accurate. It feels authentic. And it provides her with her own distinct place among the Marvel pantheon.
Yeah, totally agree. She was great, man. She had presence. She had charm. She had charisma. She's likable when she needs to be likable. Right. She's tough and mean when she needs to be tough and mean. She accounts very well in the fight scenes, some of which aren't shot the best, but her stuff in them is great. Mm-hmm. She looks like a superhero. When she is decked out finally in the full Captain Marvel gear in this movie, it's breathtaking. It's like this is a superhero on the big screen. She, in some ways, she stands out more than some of the guys have in their superhero costumes. Like she looks like she belongs. She looks like she can step in right now and be the leader of the Avengers or any group you want to throw out there. In many ways, seeing Brie Larson as Captain Marvel made me buy into the character in a way that I never have. Seeing her kind of come to life is like, okay, I get it now. She's a badass. And that's exactly what she is throughout this movie. She's a badass. She delivers her lines with panache and style and charm. She has a great back and forth with Sam Jackson's Nick Fury. She has an emotional bond and subplot going on with Maria Rambeau and Monica Rambeau. And not to be confused with John Rambeau, of course. But yeah, she's outstanding throughout the movie. I was really impressed by her performance, and anybody that was hating on her going in can suck it as far as I'm concerned, because she was – I don't see what she could have done any different in this movie.
No, I don't either. I thought she was outstanding.
Yeah, but the arguably the show-stealing performance – was by Samuel L. Jackson in this movie as Nick Fury. My mom even said that after the movie. She said, you know, I liked Captain Marvel, but Sam Jackson was great in that. He was my favorite part of the movie, and he was outstanding. Do you agree with me, Nick, that he's been underutilized in the last really several years of the MCU? Because I thought he was just great in this movie. He had the funniest lines, the funniest moments, and just I don't know, just that Sam Jackson charm to a younger, adding that to a younger Nick Fury who's not quite as battle hardened as the guy that we meet later on in Iron Man.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't, you know, he's been underutilized, but the character of Nick Fury has often been one that hasn't, especially in the modern comics, hasn't really been used as the focus of any particular story. I think Samuel L. Jackson has been underutilized. I don't know that I necessarily want to see Fury dominate plots, particularly because we've gotten him in like Avengers movies, and I want to see the Avengers. I don't, you know, Sam Jackson is nice to have there, and Fury is a nice character to have, but that's not, it's not what I'm paying to see. You know what I mean? I'll agree.
I think you can use him in solo movies too, though. Like, for your purposes, you think he wouldn't have sparked up Ant-Man, for instance?
Oh, he probably would have.
Little Nick Fury.
I'm certainly looking forward to him being in Spider-Man Far From Home, so you got that to look forward to.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, we talked about Fury earlier, so not really much more to add about that. Jackson was outstanding.
So Jude Law plays Yon Rogg in this one. And while Jude Law is a great actor, I thought Yon Rogg was pretty one-note and uninteresting for most of the movie. Uh-huh. And has a very brief moment of being interesting near the end of the movie. What were your thoughts on Jude Law?
He was fine. It's a pretty thinly written character, but, you know, he did a really good job with what was there. You can't blame him for shortcomings of the script or development of that character. So, good job.
Standout number two I wanted to talk about in the cast was, trying to find this guy's name, Ben Mendelsohn as Talos. Did I say his name right, Nick?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Did I? Yes. So, anyway, Talos, he is outstanding in this movie. I said I've used the word outstanding 400 times, but he really is. He's great. I thought he added humor, added a little level of depth to Talos, who's much more interesting than I thought he was going to be. When the movie started, I was picturing him as a rather generic early MCU villain, and by the end of it, of course, all my expectations had been turned on their head. What did you make of his performance in this one and that characterization?
He was outstanding. The character of Talos, I don't know, I'm not even sure if there is a comic book equivalent. That's how obscure individual Skrulls often are within the Marvel Comics universe. But Ben Mendelsohn, who we know from The Dark Knight Rises, who we know from Rogue One, did an outstanding job. I've never really seen him flex his comedic chops the way he does in this movie before, but he was outstanding. Kind of helped to carry the back half of the film.
Mm-hmm.
All around, I thought he did a great job. I was kind
of the most emotional moment, without spoiling it, in this movie involves Talos and his family. So that's what stood out to me, is that he takes what could have been a forgettable one note side character, and through good writing and through a great performance, makes me and the audience in general care about him and empathize with him in a way that we weren't expecting going in. And also helps to humanize Carol, because he and his story play a big part in the story of Carol Danvers and how she becomes Captain Marvel and remembers who she is and where she came from. We also need to talk about the Rambos, Monica and Maria, who Maria is Carol's friend, longtime friend, and Monica is Maria's daughter, who looks up to Carol as a mentor figure. And Lashana Lynch played Maria, and I thought she was good. And Maria herself was a fine character, not great, honestly. But I thought Monica Rambeau, who I know very little about from the comics, except that she was Captain Marvel at one point, was great in this movie. Let me explain my comment about Maria. I thought that they rushed her subplot a little bit in terms of, I don't know that we got enough of them hanging out and them being friends for me to buy their emotional bond on such a level. That it shows in the movie. The acting was fine. There was nothing wrong with her acting. I thought the writing could have been a little bit stronger on her character to give her more of a more of a presence than just being Monica's mom and Carol's friend. But still enjoyed the character. Monica was where the real star was shining, though, in my opinion. She was she stood out on the screen. Great chemistry with Carol. Great scenes with her mom, with Nick Fury, with Talos. I'm excited to see more of her going forward in future Captain Marvel movies, hopefully.
Yeah, but seemingly they would have to – we're talking about Monica Rambeau, correct?
Yes.
They'll seemingly have to recast that actress, so that should be interesting, unless they do the Wonder Woman thing and have the sequels take place in the gap between this film and her next appearance in Endgame, which is certainly an approach they could take. We've got 24 years, 23 years of timeline to play with as it relates to Captain Marvel. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to see future films explore both the present day and these two decades of history they have to fill out at some point.
Yep. Any other acting performances you wanted to mention before we move on?
None that I can recall.
Then let's move on.
Oh, Annette Bening.
Oh yes, Annette Bening as Mar-Vell.
Oh.
A Mar-Vellous twist in the film.
Well, there you go. It's too late at this point. Go ahead.
Oh God, we've done that. We've done that thing that I hate that we do, that we criticize other people for doing, where we, in reviewing a movie, we spoil everything about the movie.
Yeah, that's true.
So now we have to recast this entire show. But anyway.
Cat's out of the bag now. I think we've covered the Skrulls as sympathetic comedy figures, and now the Mar-Vell thing is. I don't really think there's any, like, you might as well just turn this into a spoiler review at this point.
Yep, that's what we're going to do. Maybe okay. That's how we'll differentiate ourselves from the other review.
Yep.
So we're going to do the spoiler-filled review. Anyway, Annette Bening as Mar-Vell was fine. Good even when she gets a chance. She doesn't get much to do in the movie, but when she's there, she's good.
She also, in her scenes as the where she portrays the Supreme Intelligence, I also liked her kind of haughtiness that she clear level of disdain and looking down her nose that she had towards Carol, which once again reminded me of the Guardians of the Universe and their attitude towards Hal Jordan.
My favorite scene involving the Kree in general during the movie was Carol's showdown with the Supreme Intelligence at the end, which is sort of the climactic action scene, really, if you want to call it that, conflict scene in the movie was that showdown. And I thought that was one of the highlights of the movie. And Annette Bening was great in that scene. She was outstanding. They gave her something to do. And I think she sunk her teeth into the Supreme Intelligence because there was more to that than the Mar-Vell / Helen Cobb / whatever they called her in the movie.
Wendy Lawson, which of course is an adaptation of the Walt Lawson alter ego that Mar-Vell took on during the early years of his time on Earth.
Brother, I had no idea Mar-Vell even had a name on Earth. Nor do I want to know this.
At one point, he was Walt Lawson and Mar-Vell and Captain Marvel, all as three distinct identities.
Now, I'm taking it this was before Rick Jones and he started switching places.
Before he and Rick Jones came to know one another more intimately, yes.
Ah, yes. Well, I thought Annette Bening was good. The action, which is really, you know, something that Marvel has improved tremendously in their movies over the years, particularly their last – you know, a few Avengers movies, the last two Captain America movies, Ragnarok. The action scenes have been getting better and better. And happy to report that, for the most part, no exception here. The hand-to-hand fighting scenes in this movie were fine. There were nothing to write home about.
I was about to say, like,
yeah,
as much of a hard-on as you have for the hand-to-hand fighting, I have an equal hard-on for space battles, for dogfights, and Star Wars-like over-the-top action. And whereas, in this case, the hand-to-hand stuff, even to a layperson like myself, I could tell was nothing particularly inventive or visually interesting. But those damn space battles, like near the end when it is Carol Danvers fully unleashed and at the peak of her powers, that was some of the best like cosmic action I've seen in the MCU. I fucking loved it.
I agree. Yeah, and the interesting thing is we talked about Guardians of the Galaxy having the same philosophy or the same sort of effect of the Star Wars movies in terms of giving us unique civilizations and planets and things like that. However, I would argue that from an action standpoint, this is the closest that the MCU has felt to Star Wars to me, because whether it's the – you talked about the scene where she flies out into space and she's doing battle with the Kree warships.
Yes.
And particularly Ronan's ship and everything like that.
Just flying through them. I mean just like – just wrecking all kinds of shots.
Just wrecking shots, shooting photon blasts. It looked awesome. It looked like, again, like a Green Lantern movie should look. However, I want to call attention to the dogfight.
In the canyon, yeah.
Through the canyon, which reminded me of – Star Wars, both the original Star Wars film and The Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. It was a breathtaking sequence that stood out to me above everything else in the movie from an action standpoint, simply because we've not seen anything like it in the MCU. It was different. Mm-hmm. It was distinct. It was a type of – it was more of a serious, you know, thrilling take on something like – you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 giving us the Galaga sequence when they're doing the – which was a great sequence. But this was a more classical space opera dogfight. And, man, it was fun. It was so good. It was like combining the best elements of a movie like a Top Gun with Star Wars and just a really, really great aesthetic to that part of the movie. I loved all of that stuff. Anything – involving action in this movie that wasn't just hand-to-hand combat was great. Car chase sequences, the sequence on the train comes to mind. All this stuff was outstanding. So big, big fan of the action in this one, Nick.
Absolutely.
So I guess that brings us to the writing on this one. And I do want to talk about the writing. By the way, while we're talking about the action – director on this one, this was directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. They are known for the movies Half Nelson, Sugar, It's Kind of a Funny Story, and Mississippi Grind, none of which I've seen. But thought they acquitted themselves pretty well from a directional standpoint. I've seen some criticism of the way the movie's put together. But frankly, outside of the beginning, I don't get that. I thought it was very well put together, very well shot.
Yeah, I think some people have taken issue with the non-linear structure of it and have said that it was only something they did just to get away from the typical origin story formula, that it didn't really serve much of a purpose in the film. I don't agree with that criticism, but
– I don't either.
You know, there you are.
I think it was refreshing for that reason, actually, because I'm so – you know, I'm so burnt out on origin stories in general. But this was as well handled as possible, I thought. Now – the screenplay was by Anna Boden, Ryan Fleck, and Geneva Robertson-Duaret. The story was by all those people, plus Nicole Perlman, plus Meg Lefevre.
Dan Lefevre, former Central Michigan quarterback.
I got a Lefevre. Mm-hmm. But all of these – what I'm saying is all these cooks in the kitchen from a writing standpoint – I thought reared its head a few times in this movie.
It did, but I think we need to be honest. At this point in the MCU, screenwriters and directors are important. I'm not sitting here and saying that they aren't, but there is one clear creative direction as it relates to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and people are being hired to carry out that direction. It is not
– right.
You know, no one is being hired to write their own take on a Captain Marvel movie.
They are being hired to write Kevin Feige's take on a Captain Marvel movie. My issues with the movie have nothing to do with the direction of the movie, but more with the execution in terms of from a writing standpoint. I thought the dialogue at times was bad. I thought this is the stuff that Greg didn't enjoy, because I liked most of the movie. I really liked most of the movie, but I thought some of the dialogue was bad. In particular, This movie tried to be funny a lot, and I thought it only succeeded a few times in actually being funny. And the times that it did succeed had more to do with the actors and their facial expressions than it did with the actual punchline. I think of one in particular moment that I thought was such a blown opportunity to be funny, which is when they're in the car and she says to Nick something along the lines of, tell me a secret about yourself that no one else knows that would prove you're not a Skrull. And Nick, instead of being anything funny, he tells her that if toast is cut diagonally, he can't eat it. And she reacts as if this was a very funny thing that he revealed to her, and it wasn't. No one in the theater laughed at this. And I was like, it was like uncomfortable. It was one of those like, kind of cringy moments. And that's just one example. But I thought there were a few examples of that throughout the movie of bad jokes and stuff that just didn't land. And I don't know if that's because of multiple rewrites. I don't know if that was just they're not good comedy writers. I don't know. But that stood out to me a few times during the movie of like, you know, the movie's at its best when it's not trying to be funny. What was your take on that particular aspect? The cat stuff was pretty funny for the most part, I thought.
Yeah, but, I don't think I was as bothered by it as you were, simply because, like you said, it was so good when it wasn't trying to be funny, and I did not feel, unlike certain other films that we've discussed, that the humor ever became the point of the film. I think the humor was...
I would disagree with that. I think that there... No, not the point of the film, no. But
right.
The point of scenes, absolutely.
Right.
The scene in the car was 100% supposed to be
right.
A laugh-out-loud moment.
What I am saying is I take issue more with movies that are supposed to be comedies, and jokes don't land for me. This was not supposed to be a comedy. It had comedic aspects, as every MCU film does, but I would not classify it as a comedy the way I would either Ant-Man movie or Thor Ragnarok, for example.
No, no. And then I would also argue that Thor Ragnarok and Ant-Man are both funny movies. And this,
yes, but
like, I'll give you another example. Something like an Avengers movie, which is not a comedy, but is way funnier than Captain Marvel. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. But I don't
But I don't
care, I guess is what I'm saying. Like,
right.
I have the MCU humor is almost always really well done. I have had plenty of it. I could do with less of it, honestly, going forward. Well,
I'm actually agreeing with you on this. I think this movie would have been much better without it.
Yep.
Because it doesn't deliver it.
Right.
I love it when it's there. But the problem is when a movie tries to deliver it and doesn't, I think is a much bigger problem than when a movie just doesn't try to do it.
Right.
And then there were just other dialogue exchanges that I thought were awkward during the movie. A lot of exposition at times. Mm-hmm.
Which is different. I mean, that's one of those things kind of like the first Green Lantern movie, you know, which we've debated mm-hmm. the merits of many times. It's when you're setting up such an expansive mythos, because I mean, much like Green Lantern, you've kind of got to do a lot of world building really quickly in this film. Yep. There's an element of exposition you're not going to be able to get around. And so I agree that there were times where it was a little heavy, but for the most part, you know, I kind of came into it expecting a degree of that. And so I kind of was more forgiving towards that.
I mean, that's fair. And again, the actors did a great job of working with what they had. And that brings me to, I want to talk about a couple of spoiler things here, which we've already gotten into big spoilers, to get just a little bit of explanation for you, having seen the movie twice. So the Tesseract, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a little confused on that. Maybe I'm misremembering things. Mm-hmm. I thought nobody could just pick up and have the Tesseract. How are people just handling the Tesseract in this movie?
I don't recall there being a problem with handling it.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm just misremembering that.
Because I remember Red Skull handled it in First Avengers. Or First Avenger, excuse me, not First Avengers. Those are two separate films. Red Skull handled it, and then he had been using it and activated it, you know, on his ship near the end of that film, and then when he tried to pick it up because it was active, it, as we later found out, it wound up sucking him through a wormhole or whatever.
Right.
I'm fairly sure it was handled in Avengers by different characters. Then I don't know what happened to it after Avengers, honestly.
Yeah, and I guess the timeline of it is kind of confusing me as well. I need to go back and actually look up online, like what the.
I do know that it was like Howard Stark finds it at the end of First Avenger and picks it up. So the implication is that it's in S.H.I.E.L.D. custody for some time. And they mentioned
that Pegasus is part of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, they mentioned in this project, in this film, that Pegasus is a joint project between S.H.I.E.L.D., NASA, and the Air Force. And so you would think that it was directly delivered and then went missing at Mar-Vell's direction and then was recovered, went back to, you know, that whole timeline. You know, that's the one aspect of it is I feel like the Tesseract wasn't really necessary. I felt like it was kind of a forced tie to the other films. And I know they're going to say that, you know, it was the what was used to help create this light speed engine or whatever. But you easily could have just had Mar-Vell create the thing using Kree technology and it be the thing that winds up giving Carol her powers. I don't think the Tesseract was necessary for that unless they have big plans for her, you know, and her tie to the Tesseract being key to defeating Thanos in Endgame. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see what comes out of that.
Right, yeah. But it didn't – I mean, I thought it was kind of a – you know, all that being said, I thought it was kind of a cool nod. Like, I thought it was like, okay, here's a stronger tie to the MCU. You know, it didn't bother
me. It's just funny to me that, like, the Tesseract, that's their one that they, like – there are how many Infinity Stones, and it took us forever. But the Tesseract's been in, like, five movies at this point. You know, you could have chosen something else, but, you know, whatever. That's a nitpick.
But like, Right. Yeah. No. And overall, the movie was so fun and so dynamic, and the scene involving the cat Goose was all those scenes were great. Were really funny, and the mid credit scene in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point this out. Oh. This is one of my favorite mid credit scene or it is, scenes in any Marvel movie.
It is on par with the "I guess I'll have to do it myself" from Civil War. I think that was Civil War. Or was it Age of Ultron? I forget. Maybe Civil War. I don't remember. Anyways, where Thanos puts on the Infinity Gauntlet for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was on par with that because, like, again, not being a huge fan of Carol Danvers from the comics, not even really knowing that much about her, I am already like when she showed up in that end credit scene, I was like, oh, Thanos is fucked. It was my instant reaction.
That was the most like. It's weird to say this, Nick, but that was probably the most DC moment in a Marvel movie to this point.
Yeah.
Not DC movies, but DC comics.
Yes.
Was that not like when you're reading a DC event and either Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman shows up and it's like everybody else just stops and stares, you know?
Yes.
Like this is a – it was almost like a minuscule encapsulation of that moment that we talked about at the end of Infinity War when Thor shows up.
Yes.
To save them in battle. But it was like fist-pumpingly awesome. It was so inspirational.
Speaking
that moment of like, you know, yes, Thanos is screwed. Thanos is in trouble. But just like she is a freaking badass.
Yes.
And I could instantly believe that she would walk into the room and take over the Avengers from Cap.
Yes. Speaking of – you brought up Thor there. I am actually going to take a brief moment to advocate. And this is rare, Greg. I'm going to advocate for a comedic bit I want to see in Endgame. They have made a running joke out of every female virtually in the MCU that Thor has encountered, like kind of stumbling over him and fawning over his physical appearance. I want Thor like love struck by the first time he lays eyes on Carol Danvers in Endgame. I want to see it. I hope it happens.
Yeah, that would be awesome. That would be great. She do that the mid credit scene, the ending of the movie. This was a movie that, just sort of summarizing my thoughts on it, this was a movie that picks up steam as it goes.
Yes.
And I'd much rather have that than a movie that starts out great and fizzles at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really strong, in particular the mid and end credit scenes. Your thoughts, your overall thoughts on Captain Marvel?
I thought it was really, really well done. Like we've discussed, not without its flaws, but every MCU movie has its flaws. They're, you know, perfect films don't really exist. Or if they do, they don't exist in the MCU because the MCU doesn't have Chris Nolan. There's a shout out to Tim Capel there. But it was very well done. It made me care about a character I don't know a whole lot about. Packed a lot in there into its roughly 2-hour running time. Was well-paced, as you said, kind of built momentum as it went along. So, yeah, big thumbs up for me. As far as the solo introductory movies go, and we'll discuss this here in a moment, one of the better ones that they've put out there. But one more thing I think we should discuss before we wrap it up were the two different kind of tributes to Stan Lee that were in film.
The
opening Marvel Studios logo, which is often, which in recent years has contained different footage from every MCU film that has been released, kind of playing on top of the letters in Marvel Studios. All of that footage was replaced this time with footage from either Stan cameos or actual footage of Stan Lee. So it was an all Stan montage to open the film, complete with a thank you Stan that popped up on screen as soon as the logo dissipated. I thought that was a really, really cool tribute to Stan, and I would even be fine with it staying on through the rest of 2019 and the two more MCU films that are yet to be released.
Yeah, I loved them. I thought they were wonderful, and that opening sequence in particular, the opening crawl or whatever, was, you know, how do you not look at that and smile? You know, like, it was heartbreaking to a degree, but it was more.
It was.
More inspiring, more just joyful, you know, to see Stan up there. And I think that we will and should see it for the foreseeable future in MCU movies.
And then, of course, the Stan cameo in this one. I personally loved that as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Reading, especially the tie to your boy Kevin Smith with Mallrats. So that was fun.
Indeed it was.
Well, with that being said, both of us give this movie a big thumbs up. Mm-hmm. Another success for the MCU. They just don't miss, generally speaking. So
no, they don't.
Or even just at all. So what are we going to do now, Nick? Are we going to unveil? Oh, no, you wanted to talk about your theater experience, right?
Yeah, and that actually kind of ties in nicely to something that I kind of did without running it by you, but I think you'll agree once we talk about it. It is no secret that this film has had a little bit of controversy surrounding it.
Now, is this the kind of controversy that creates cash? Apparently so.
Apparently it did, considering it's the sixth highest opening weekend worldwide of all time. So congratulations, angry white men, at your ability to really hurt this movie financially. I'm not really sure what it is, Greg. Like, I remember there being a small amount of this, or a smaller, I should say, amount of this when Black Panther came out. But there were a lot of people who were just very upset by this film and its perceived feminist agenda as it was preparing to be released. What is your perspective on that? I'm genuinely curious because
I don't understand it.
Like, I don't understand where it comes from or what it – they had not seen the movie, and it was just assumed that it featured a female, it was going to be feminist in nature, which it wound up being, but that's
– but I don't think there was nothing in that movie that felt at no point during this movie did I feel like they were being they were beating me over the head with any kind of a message or a quote point.
Right.
They were sending a message that women can kick ass as much or more than the men. And they were doing it in a very nice, subtle way. There weren't a lot of, men are so stupid and women are so awesome bits of dialogue in there. They just showed you through the story of how they gave us strong male characters, strong female characters, people of different races. This was one of the most inclusive movies that Marvel has done to this point. Mm-hmm. And for once,
to some people,
right. For once, it was refreshing to see Marvel present a strong woman lead character in a movie. It's long overdue, long overdue. And that's that aspect of it. I did not sense any sort of agenda in there, but if it was there, it was handled with such class and precision that it wasn't like some of the bad Supergirl episodes where even we've been like, all right, we get it. We know the point that you're trying to get here. You don't have to be so blunt with the instrument, so to speak.
And it must be pointed out that pro-woman does not mean anti-man. And I think that assumption has been made by many individuals.
Yeah, so I think there's different subsets of people that I've encountered who have been upset about this film before it even comes out.
Right.
Number one is the people who are upset about an interview that Brie Larson did that has been blown way out of context, where she indicated that she wanted to see more women movie critics and not to see as many white male movie critics, which there are an astronomically large amount of white male movie critics. And her comments were blown out of proportion to the degree that it was turned into, she doesn't want white men to see the movie Captain Marvel, which I could be wrong, but I don't believe she ever has said. So that's one group of people who are taking a comment out of context because they probably want to take that comment out of context, for the record. Number two is a group of people who hate the idea of Carol Danvers as Captain Marvel in the first place. These are hardcore comic book fans that believe Captain Marvel, that believe Carol Danvers should still be Miss Marvel, and that changing her into Captain Marvel was a, quote, SJW move,
oh, God,
end quote, from Marvel.
Oh, God. Yeah,
and they don't, they've never accepted her in that role, and they don't like her character, and they don't like that move. SJW, bro. So, and then the third subset of people that I've encountered that were negative towards this through the movie is a group of people who resent the very idea of that are so paranoid that they resent the idea of a woman-led superhero movie because they feel that it will be some sort of attack on them personally or on their subset of white male nerds. We've encountered this in comics as well, Nick, constantly, comic book fans. But it also applies to movie fans as well, that are very threatened by everything not being catered directly to them.
Yes.
As the majority of pop culture has been throughout history.
Yes.
So, and then there's a fourth subset of people who, I wouldn't include with any of those other people are probably paranoid about the idea of this being a movie that you are not allowed to dislike. So what I mean by that is people that I've encountered that I've talked to that said that my worry is that I will go and see this movie and not like it, but I can't say that I don't like it because I'll be lumped in with the assholes in groups 1, 2, and 3.
Which, I mean, not to put you in an uncomfortable position, but you expressed that you felt that way to a degree about The Last Jedi after it was released. And your reaction to that film.
Yes. Yes. I think, I did feel that way about it. I did not feel that way about Captain Marvel.
No, I was Last Jedi specifically.
Right. Last Jedi, yes, I did feel that way. And to a degree, still do.
Right.
But that's why I don't talk about that movie very much online. But you know that the reasons that I disliked that movie had absolutely nothing to do with messaging.
Right.
So, anyway, yeah. But it. Yeah, so these are the four groups of people that I've encountered on this movie, and I have no issue. I think there were plenty of issues with this movie that just didn't bother me as much as they bother other people.
Right.
So I totally understand somebody watching this movie and not liking it. I watched it and really liked it.
Right.
I thought it was very good. The problem is when people prejudge a movie based on their own paranoias and their own biases – or their perception of other people's biases against them. Mm-hmm. And it creates this us versus the world mentality. Oh, there's a fifth group of people that I didn't even mention that I see more on Twitter than anywhere else, which is hardcore DCEU fans.
Oh, God.
Hate the concept of this movie for some reason, it seems. And
– well, they are also – those people, the hardest of the hardcore, the most extreme of those DCEU fans are also convinced – that Disney is paying movie critics to give Marvel movies artificially inflated positive reviews. And I would again point out that of the DCEU films, you know, Man of Steel forward, every Marvel movie has been better than almost every DCEU movie.
Right.
It's
well, and also we have seen that Wonder Woman and if you I don't want to say this because always agree with the critics. I don't always agree with the critics, but the movies that have been good have gotten good reviews.
Typically, yes. Typically, you know, generally speaking.
Mostly good reviews. Right. Anyway. And there are always exceptions. And you can't account for taste and for, you know, people's it's all subjective. I don't really care that much about what movie critics think about the movies that I like or don't like.
No, I don't either.
But this
– It is a pretty unprecedented run of success though. I mean, like
– right.
You know, people grasping at, well, they must be paying them to give them positive reviews because not all of them are good. They kind of all are, though. Like, we've talked about that. Even the worst MCU
movie. Even the worst MCU movie, no matter which one it is on our respective list, is good.
Like, it's a good movie.
I could watch it. If it came on TV, I'm not going to turn the channel.
Right.
You know, like, it's not like I would if
– so.
You know, so a bad movie came out. But again, it's an unnecessary segmentation of the audience because there is no DCEU versus MCU battle. That doesn't exist. No. That only exists in the minds of a very small
audience. And if you wanted to create a battle and you are on that hardcore DCEU side, it is not a battle you want to be in. Let's be – like it is no contest. It is what it is. Like it's
– And if you prefer the DCEU, that's fine. But again, you shouldn't let that affect the way that you perceive every Marvel movie come out. Like, there's this idea that I see this perpetrated online that MCU movies are all comedy. They're all light fluff. They don't mean anything. They have no value. They have no
or they're all really the same, which is a view that you and I have disagreed on to certain levels. Not saying that you think they're all exactly the same, but you have criticized an element of sameness about them.
Yes, and I would agree that I think that recently that's changed. I think the early movies very much had an element of sameness about them. But good, the sameness is not necessarily inherently bad. You know, Star Wars has an element of sameness about the movies, and that's not necessarily bad. I think I would argue that Last Jedi diverging from that hampered my enjoyment of it. But that being said, the MCU, they are different, especially in recent years. I think the inclusion of guys like James Gunn and Taika Waititi helped to give a different dynamic to, and the Russo brothers helped to bring a different dynamic to the MCU, where they feel like the same universe but distinct movies. And
go ahead. Sorry.
No. So, but no, there is a divide amongst the films that that the MCU movies are all the view is that the MCU movies are all you know, light fluff, and that's not necessarily true. And again, even if it is, it's not inherently a bad thing. So yeah, I don't know. Yes, I've been critical of MCU movies, and I will remain critical of MCU movies going forward in bits and pieces. But I love the MCU. I like almost all the movies, in fact. This but again, I don't feel this us versus them mentality of the fact that I like Man of Steel means that I should hate Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever, you know?
So this kind of brings me or dovetails nicely with my initial theater experience. So I had family stuff going on Thursday. You know, you and I know the circumstances behind that. It's boring to anybody else. But typically I see these films, the first screening they are shown in my area. I was not able to do that. I kind of wound up catching a last minute, I think it was like a 10:30 showing, so relatively late. Got out of the movie, you know, by the time you did trailers and credits and everything, like 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. I'm not really sure. So the movie had been out on the East Coast for all of about 6 hours. But throughout the film, there was an individual behind me who was audibly complaining about a variety of things. Comedic scrolls seem to be the biggest thing, but then also there's a montage near the end of the film that shows Carol Danvers at different ages being knocked down and getting back up. And he had something snarky to say about that. I don't even remember what his comment was. But then at the very end of the film, the last scene involving Sam Jackson that makes a reveal as it relates to the name of the group, the Avengers, he bitched about that during the lead up to the entire post credit scene, calling it a bullshit SJW retcon, I believe was the exact term that was used, and just different stuff like that. And was instantly commenting to his friends and his group that he was with that he could not wait to get home and, quote, downvote the shit out of that movie. And so that led me, again, at like 12:30, 1 o'clock, I was kind of curious to see what kind of fan response it was getting. And you may remember, Greg, last year during the build-up to Black Panther, we removed the Rotten Tomatoes fan score from our kind of index here for our power rankings that we use for the critical reaction. And the reason we did that was because it was getting review bombed. It was very notable at that point that it was that was happening. And so I was like, all right, well, we know that's happening to Rotten Tomatoes because Rotten Tomatoes has already suspended the audience score for Captain Marvel before the movie was ever released because of that. And I was like, let me go on IMDb and see what's happening over there. At the time that I pulled that up, Greg, Captain Marvel was receiving a 6.3 audience score on IMDb. That, if it had held, would have been the lowest IMDb score of the entire MCU. Now, you and I can sit here, and we can certainly, like we said, have legitimate issues with the film, but do you think there's a rational viewpoint for this being the worst of the MCU films?
Probably not. I mean, I can't judge other people, you know.
Right.
The people view movies differently.
I agree, but what I'm saying is it
certainly wouldn't be anywhere near my pick for the bottom of the MCU.
And it feels like it has become this thing where fan scores now are being – there was always an element of arbitration, you know, just have it being arbitrary in nature. But they have become increasingly artificially swayed one way or the other. And so I just dropped fan scores altogether from our index, and I didn't figure you would have a problem with it. Given the reason,
I'm fine with that. I think it's unfortunate because I think it was a good. I think it's a good thing to separate audiences from critics. But the only thing I can think of to do it in a fair way would be to use box office receipts or to use more. You know, but there's no way to do it because the only other way would
inflation.
Be to use, or to use the audience score,
cinema
or whatever
score
that you see on cinema score. Yeah, and that is.
Not
which
numerical.
Is done on exit polling.
Right.
Right. And that's not numerical. So there's no way for us to use that. So I'm fine.
Cinema scores that below an A- are exceptionally rare because most people that paid money to go see a movie for entertainment wind up getting some form of entertainment out of it. General audiences are not comic book audiences.
Oh, I'm mostly like that as well. Like I very rare is the time when I go to a movie and I leave it and I'm not satisfied with paying my money. Cause even if a movie's mediocre, I usually enjoy the experience and I usually come out of it like, okay, that wasn't the greatest thing. I always like a movie better in the theater than when I watch it on home video.
Outstanding.
Almost always.
So with that being said, we're going to dive here into our critical ranking, which has been revised. It used to be that the maximum score was 300 points. It is now 200 points. It is exclusively the Rotten Tomatoes score and the Metacritic score added together. So one moment here. I'm going to quickly verify that these numbers are accurate because with Captain Marvel having just come out, the film is, of course, kind of sliding around as it relates to scoring. The numbers are going up or down or what have you. So, Greg, kill time.
Well, you know, time's an interesting thing in that some would argue that it doesn't exist. Others argue that it does exist. Me, I don't know. I'm no scientist. I do know the Hootie and the Blowfish song talking about time and saying that time, you know, asking the question, the eternal question, time, why you punish me? You know, I think that's a question that all of us can relate to. However, the Rolling Stones were more certain that time was indeed on their side. And, you know, I believe it was the Birds, perhaps, or was it the Zombies that had the notion that it's the time of the season for.
All right. Thank you for the killing of time. We are prepared to move forward with our 20 beginning at number 21 again out of 200 possible points. At number 21, Thor: The Dark World with 120 points. At number 20, The Incredible Hulk with 128. At 19, Iron Man 2 with 130. At 18, Thor with 134. At 17, Avengers: Age of Ultron with 141 points. At 16, Iron Man 3 with 142 points. At 15, Captain Marvel with a Rotten Tomatoes score of 79 and a Metacritic score of 64. That's 143 total points. At a tie for 13th, Ant-Man and Captain America: The First Avenger, each with 146 points. At number 12, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 with 151 points. At number 11, Avengers: Infinity War with 153 points. At number 10, Ant-Man and the Wasp with 158 points. At number 9, Captain America the Winter Soldier with 160 points. At number 8, Doctor Strange with 100... Excuse me, let me rephrase. In a tie for 7th, both The Avengers and Doctor Strange with 161 points. Craig, I need to hear your thoughts on The Avengers and Doctor Strange being considered equal in the eyes of critics.
Well, sir, don't like it.
Oh, at number 6, Spider-Man Homecoming with 165 points. At number 5, Captain America Civil War. In a tie for 4th, Thor Ragnarok and Captain America Civil War with 166 points. At number 3, Guardians of the Galaxy with 167 points. At number 2, Iron Man with 172 points. And at number 1, Black Panther with 185 points.
Great gosh. Is there that big a discrepancy between Black Panther and Iron Man? I mean, they're both great movies, but... Lord have mercy.
4 points difference on the Rotten Tomatoes score, 9 points difference on the Metacritic score. So,
wow. Well, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. All right, Nick, let me go first on this one, our personalized rankings, and I'll try to get the numbers right. There's 21 films, right?
21 films, yep.
All right. At number 21, with a bullet, I have Doctor Strange. At number 20, I have The Incredible Hulk. At number 19, I have Thor the Dark World. At number 18, I have Thor. At number 17, I have Captain America : The First Avenger. At number 16, I have Ant-Man. What number is this? 15? Mm-hmm. I have Spider-Man Homecoming. At number 14, I have Captain Marvel. At number 13, I have Ant-Man and the Wasp. At number 12, I have Iron Man. At number 11, I have Iron Man 3, apparently. At number 10, I have Iron Man 2. At number 9, I have Avengers Age of Ultron. At number 8, Black Panther. 7, Guardians of the Galaxy. 6, The Avengers. 5, Thor Ragnarok. 4, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. 3, Captain America the Winter Soldier. 2, Avengers Infinity War. And at number 1 still is Captain America Civil War.
There you are. You did well that time. You know, you didn't stumble over the rankings as you often have in the past. So, in any event, now on to a far more accurate list. At number 21, I have Ant-Man. At number 20, I have Ant-Man and the Wasp. At number 19, I have Iron Man 3. At number 18, I have The Incredible Hulk. At number 17, I have Thor the Dark World. I have Doctor Strange at 16. Iron Man 2 at 15. Thor Ragnarok at 14. Captain America the First Avenger at 13. I have Thor at 12. I have Captain Marvel at 11. Just there in terms of that top 10 cutoff. At number 10, I have Black Panther. At 9, I have Iron Man. At 8, I have Avengers Infinity War. I have Guardians of the Galaxy at 7, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 at 6, Spider-Man Homecoming at 5, The Avengers at 4, The Avengers Age of Ultron at 3, Captain America Civil War at 2, and still my number 1, especially, I did a recent rewatch of this and loved it just as much this time, Captain America the Winter Soldier is my undisputed number 1.
Very good.
Indeed.
Well, with all that said, with all that rigmarole over, this very long episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys rolls on right after this break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. The Place to be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and HistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. As you just heard, we've got a lot of great shows here across our wonderful networks at Place to Be Nation. And let me just remind you about some of the stuff that you can check out on our Pop Feed right now. We had a busy week on the Pop Feed with a little something for just about everyone. In the premiere episode of Binge Please, the manager, Todd Weber, explains the concept of his new show and also highlights Netflix's penis, or Pen 15. Steve and Kelly are back in the house with a brand new Songs with Friends.
Speaking of highlighting penises.
Breaking down penises, November Rain and Frontin'. The Great Debate number 4 has dropped with host Andy Atherton welcoming in Russell Sellers with an S at the end of his name and David Sunday, Jason Sherman, and Steve Patty to debate subjects across a spectrum of topics. That's a good group of our buddies there gathering together to talk about pop culture. Andrew and Adam are back with a brand new NBA team podcast and a survey of the landscape and what seems to be on the horizon in their eyes for the teams across the league as the regular season kind of winds down here in the NBA. The Hard Traveling Fanboys are us, and so we don't have to chill our own products, but we will catch out our Captain Marvel month offerings about the death of Captain Marvel and also
the first volume of the 2012 series.
Yes, yes, that one. And furthermore, a new Talk and Pop featuring Tim and Jenny as they suffer for your entertainment with a live watch of My Father the Hero. And be sure to stop by the Geek and Sassy Facebook page where you can grab and complete a ballot for the second annual Sassy Awards. Make your voice heard. Nick, what's going on over at the Wrestling Feed?
Well, the Wrestling Feed, of course, has the Wrestling Warzone podcast as JT and Chad take a deep dive into the final pay-per-view of the year for the WWF back in 1996. That'd be – or 1995, excuse me. That'd be In Your House number 5. We also had episode 514 of the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, where Scott and JT were joined by Peter Winson to check out the legendary NBC's main event from February of 1989. We also saw the debut of a brand new Podblast series from some people named Greg Phillips and Nick Duke. What If Wrestling? In this premiere installment, we dive into what would have happened if Ric Flair had joined the WWF in 1988. But we're not all about podcasting here at Place to Be Nation. No, far from it. We also have a vibrant print media website, which is, of course, not a dying industry in today's day and age at all. We have things back up and running over at PlaceToBeNation.com. As March rolls in, we're going to have lots of written content picking back up in the days and weeks to come. And, of course, finally, be sure to give a like on Facebook to the PTVN Greatest Candy Tournament. The Facebook page there, so you can participate in daily polls as we determine which candy is indeed the greatest of all time. Things got kicked off on March the 10th with a champion crowned, scheduled to be crowned on Easter Sunday. A Podblast featuring Andy Atherton, JT, and Michael Cool recently dropped on Pop Feed with the boys breaking down the field, so check it out.
Michael Cool, huh?
Hey, man, listen. I don't write this shit. I deliver it as written. As far as I'm concerned, I don't know any Russell Sellers. Russell Seller is the only person I'm aware of.
Now, wait just a minute. Now, the one thing I do have for you, what candy is going to finish second to Reese's in the candy tournament, Nick?
If I had to pick one, I would say I'm going to go Butterfinger.
Ooh, a Butterfinger. Crispity, crunchity, and peanut buttery. I like it. That's a good pick, actually. I have a rather unique opinion, apparently, that I didn't realize was so unique, and that my favorite candy bar is the Baby Ruth. The Baby Ruth. Chocolate. I mean, it's pretty simple. Chocolate, you know, nuts are in there somewhere.
It looks like it looks like a turd when it floats in a pool.
It looks like a turd when you drop it in a pool. Yeah. That's one of the biggest factors favoring it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Twix is good, too. I like Twix.
Oh, yeah,
too.
Twix is underrated. Twix is underrated. Yep. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's also the classic Snickers. I mean, Snickers is...
Oh, Snickers is a solid choice, certainly. The ones that need to just be eliminated early... Or any of the Almond Joys or anything that's got sort of that coconut in it?
Yeah, it needs to go.
Leave your coconut out of my candy.
The ones that are just heavily based on just plain chocolate, too. Like, nobody's going to want – you don't go to the grocery store and be like, I just really want a Hershey bar that's nothing but chocolate. Nobody wants that crap.
Yeah, it's just too much. Too much of a good thing. Mm-hmm. Unlike that country song, it's not a good thing. Remember that song, Nick?
What song, Greg?
Too much of a good thing. It's a good thing. I believe it was Alan Jackson.
Now, I do remember – I don't remember that, but I do remember Too Much Fun.
Now, who did that one? I don't remember that one.
I want to say Joe Diffie, but I may be wrong.
I should know that one then. The great – we are legally obligated to call him the great Joe Diffie.
Excuse me. It was Daryl Singletary.
Oh.
Too Much Fun. What's that mean, Greg? It's like too much money. There's no such thing.
Did Cletus T. Judd ever do a parody version of that?
God, I can only hope.
When are we going to launch a Cletus T. Judd deep dive pod blast series?
Probably the same time we launch Potting Iron.
Or the same time we do a second episode of What If Wrestling.
He did make a comeback recently. Yeah, last year he made he came back with a song called "Weights Going Up Down Up Down," and it was intended to be a parody of.
Oh God! And let me tell you, if you want to challenge yourself mentally, spiritually, and otherwise, listen to that song and try to get through the whole thing. Because even me, as a Cletus T. Judd appreciator of sorts, it was a struggle to get through that one with all of it, unless you love hearing a guy saying up down up down.
Well, you know, he was paranoid. You know, he was making a commentary on the state of country music today, Greg. You have to be willing to accept that. It's no She's Got a Butt Bigger Than the Beatles, but my God, what is
I mean, when you peak that early in your career, you're really just setting the stage for failure later on. I mean, that was sort of the Let It Be of 90s country, was it not? You know, that was his Rocket Man or
let's not forget
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Let's not also forget Refried Beans and of course God almighty. And of course, his parody of Drinking Problem, Stinking Problem.
Stinking Problem.
Has there ever been anything
we've discussed on this show
that so few people can appreciate as Cletus T. Judd?
When he gets his Rami Malek-led biopic made about him. It's going to be called Butt Bigger Than the Beatles.
Well, you need to hurry up and do it before Guy Fieri dies. That's the problem.
Oh, what are we even on about? What does this have to do with Captain Marvel Month or comic books at all?
Nothing.
All right. Well, let's move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. A little segment we like to call... The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
And the biggest news, we thought, coming out of these last 2 weeks, at least in our world for comic books, was some rather bittersweet or just bitter news for us. As anyone who's listened to us for a long time knows, Since our very first episodes of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Arrow has been our sort of number one top comic book ongoing show. It's been the one that's been there every season for us. We've often said when it's on, it's by far our favorite of the DC shows. And unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. And we found out this past week from straight from the horse's mouth from Stephen Amell that Arrow will end this fall with a 10-episode final season. Reading the statement or the statement from Stephen Amell on Twitter, playing Oliver Queen has been the greatest professional experience of my life, but you can't be a vigilante forever. Arrow will return for a final run of 10 episodes this fall. There's so much to say as Scott Steiner makes another entrance in my apartment here. For now, I just want to say thank you. And he further elaborated in a Facebook Live video that I would not recommend watching as it's very emotional, that essentially this was his decision, that he came to the producers last season, I believe he said, maybe early this season, and told them that he wanted – actually, it was last season because he came to them and said that he wanted to bow out gracefully after what became this season. But that he wanted the show to continue. However, the producers got together. They mutually agreed that there is no show without Stephen Amell. And so they wanted to bring the show to an end. So they got together with Amell, talked to him, and they all agreed to do this 10-episode final season to wrap everything up. He was very emotional about this because there's a lot of great actors on the show, a lot of writers, a lot of producers, a lot of behind-the-scenes people that are invested in this. But he made the best decision for him. And you know, like you said, you can't be a vigilante forever. You can't keep doing these stunts forever. You can't keep dressing up in the costume forever. So probably the best move that he can make for himself. But, man, it sucks for us fans because I actually thought that the show kind of, after dipping in season four, as we talked about, I really had a creative renaissance in seasons five and the latter half of season six. And has been very good this year as well. So, big bummer, Nick. I don't know that we still. I've still fully grasped the concept because the show's still going strong. But this time next year, we will no longer have Arrow to discuss your show.
That's true. Although he did say that he was not going away forever, and he said that anyone who has watched the Arrowverse over the years would know what that means. So, perhaps our worries about killing off the character are unfounded, but it could all just be a smokescreen. We'll have to wait and see. But yes, this is tough news, even though I understand it. Like, it, the last thing I want is for the show to go on and on and not have a defined endpoint in mind, and then CW pull the plug and you have, you know, rushed ending that doesn't feel built to or earned. Mm-hmm. And this way, at least, the writers now have a year to focus on
telling that story,
getting there, and whatever that means.
The worst, the you don't want any show to overstay its welcome. Obviously, as a fan, you hope it goes on forever. But also, you don't want a show to become The Walking Dead, where it becomes a parody of itself over time and seems to go on in spite of itself. But it does suck, and we will certainly be dedicating a theme month to Arrow within the next calendar year. No question about that. We've got to talk about the details of what we're going to do to celebrate this show. And when time comes, we will. But for now, we're going to enjoy the ride. It's been a good season, and hopefully we'll continue to be one moving forward. The other big news coming out of Arrow is a casting announcement that is really fun for people, I think, that are in the geek culture, if you will. And that is that former Ghostbuster Ernie Hudson, who, of course, played Winston Zeddemore, will be playing an as-yet-unnamed role in CW's Arrow, according to Deadline. He will play a four-star general assigned to the Defense Intelligence Agency. And the article appears unaware that Diggle's – the Newsarama article appears unaware that Diggle's code name is Spartan. But anyway, that's the title of the episode, and it relates to Diggle, not Hudson. But yeah, so Nick, really cool casting announcement here to see Ernie Hudson join the Arrowverse.
Yeah, that actually is cool. I'm looking forward to that very much.
And our last bit of Arrowverse news is that The Flash is getting a brand new showrunner for season 6. The current showrunner, Todd Helbing, is stepping down at the conclusion of season 5 to focus on development for WB Television. And he is going to be replaced by Eric Wallace, who has been a co-executive producer since season 4. I don't know how to feel about this, Nick, only because I don't know if Wallace is going to have that different of a perspective. However, I think that we saw the new showrunner of Arrow bringing in some new ideas and a new way of looking at things that kind of freshened things up, particularly with that prison story arc at the beginning of the season. Maybe this is exactly what The Flash needs, a little shot in the arm, just a little bit of a different perspective maybe. And maybe we can get because I've been a little underwhelmed by this season of The Flash, mm-hmm. as we've talked about on the show, with some good episodes here and there. But hopefully something that can kind of change the course of the show and refocus it a little bit. What are your thoughts on the change in showrunner?
Yeah, you certainly hope that happens, at least especially as it relates to villains. The Thawne stuff has been outstanding this year on Flash, but even the villains of the week have been a little weak, for lack of a better term. And, of course, the Cicada conflict is just dragging the show down. So hopefully some new ideas and fresh perspectives as it relates to big bads coming in next season.
Well, Nick, now we come to the portion of the show where I admit that I'm wrong about something. And this particular portion of the show involves Disney Plus, an app that at one time I expressed my doubts that I would be interested in, as I am not a big Disney fan.
Actually, you skipped one.
Did I skip one?
You did.
Oh, gosh, I did. Well, let us tackle that, shall we?
Whatever.
In the world of television, before we get to Disney Plus, AMC's The Walking Dead, a show which I am behind on now by like 3 episodes, but a show that has certainly had its issues in recent seasons, both with its audience numbers and with critical reception and with our reception, but a show that I was starting to enjoy before the midseason break. Has confirmed they are AMC has confirmed that they are launching a third Walking Dead TV series. It is in active development, and they're not announcing premiere plans, but they say they have hired creative people that have pitched story outlines. They feel very good about the development of that series. This is in addition, by the way, to Andrew Lincoln's series of spinoff movies that are planned. Mm. Now, I'm of two minds about this, Nick. I was thinking about this the other day when I was doing something boring. I was like, man, this is a lot like The Walking Dead. And then it occurred to me, I was like, you know, I'm of two minds about this because on the one hand, I'm thinking – my thought is you should focus on making one good show before you turn around and make 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 Walking Dead shows. It feels like, you know, when you're dividing all of your attention between that many properties, everything's going to suffer, especially if the first property is not good. Mm-hmm. And Walking Dead has certainly not proven that it can be consistently good in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But – then I thought about it of like, well, when I think about it, I haven't watched Fear the Walking Dead since season 1. It may be a great show for all I know. However, I really enjoy the Walking Dead video games from Telltale. Great stuff. We've talked about those here.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. I enjoy other – I think there are ways of telling good stories in the Walking Dead universe.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that through the show at times. And so my thought was, well, maybe this is a chance to tell a different kind of story with different set of characters that might be good in a way that Walking Dead is maybe more different from the Walking Dead mm-hmm. show than what Fear the Walking Dead is.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I've arrived at the thought that I'm still not terribly interested in it. But I do think now, as I think about it, that maybe there is a chance to tell a – if they're going to be different with it, to tell a different kind of story here that can use the concept and the world mm-hmm. in a way that's entertaining like the video games were, as opposed to what they – did in the last couple seasons on The Walking Dead.
A couple of things here, as I often do, to shoot down your optimism. Initially, the pitch of Fear the Walking Dead, was it not that it would be different from Walking Dead because it was going to focus on the early days of the zombie outbreak?
Yes.
Okay. Neither of us have watched the show in recent years, but is it not our understanding that a couple of seasons ago they essentially did away with that by having a massive time jump forward into the midst of the zombie conflict to link up with Morgan joining the show, so that now yes. it's essentially the same thing as Walking Dead, just with a different group of characters?
Yes, hopefully with a more likable group of characters.
Yes. The other thing, last year, after we were both so frustrated with The Walking Dead, The Walking Dead changed showrunners, did it not?
Yes.
And the result of that change in showrunners was that previous showrunner Scott Gimple was then essentially received a promotion to oversee the entire, quote, Walking Dead television universe. Did he not?
Yes.
Seemingly he would be overseeing this new project as well.
Yes. Good point.
There you go.
Good point. I still have hope about this season of The Walking Dead. Now, I'm three episodes behind, so I don't know what the new episodes are doing. But, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. That's a good point. We'll have to see what becomes of it, though, Nick. But another thing that we'll have to see what becomes of is Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. As I was mentioning before, I was not rudely, but just interrupted in a kind way to remind me of my oversight, was that I was not on board with Disney Plus because I thought, hey, I'm not a big Disney fan. The Star Wars movies, I've seen them all. I'm not going to sit here and watch Star Wars movies all the time. So I'm not really – it doesn't really have that much of an appeal to me.
Wasn't interested in Star Wars live-action television shows?
I was interested, but not as interested when I heard the premise. The original – when I heard rumors of what the premise would be anyway. I'm more into it now than I was then. But over time, they started to whittle away at me. Star Wars live-action show, sure, that could be cool. Even though the parts of Star Wars and the Star Wars universe that – appeal the most to me are not the things that appeal to a lot of folks, I guess, but still should be fun. I think it's going to be awesome, actually. But I'm not going to buy a service for one show, generally speaking. Then they start rolling out these Marvel properties. The Loki show, the Scarlet Witch and Vision show, the Falcon and Bucky show. And I'll be honest, they probably already hooked me with that. But the latest announcement only puts that over the top, because one of my favorite things that Marvel does and has done consistently for 40 years now or longer is a little series that our good pal JR calls What If? Asking hypothetical questions of what if, such as what if Wolverine killed the Hulk? What if Loki had found the hammer of Thor? What if the Avengers never lost anybody? These kinds of questions. What if Austin held the WWF title for 50 consecutive years? Questions like that. And Marvel is now turning, Marvel Studios that is, turning that what if concept into a TV show for Disney Plus, an animated TV show, granted, but an animated TV show using the stories and characters from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, overseen by Kevin Feige. Nick, does this not sound like one of the best things?
Yes. It sounds amazing. Like, I am all in on this. Using previously established MCU material as the launching point for this should be amazing. I cannot wait. And as the report, I believe initial report from Slash Film or Variety or something of that nature notes, the plan as of right now is that even the actors that are departing the MCU after Endgame, or that we believe to be departing the MCU after Endgame, will likely be – pitches will be made to have them reprise their roles for this, because it will just be a voice acting role that would conceivably be far less time consuming than a actual physical live action role.
Indeed. indeed to all of that. One other project that I'm looking forward to is James Gunn's Suicide Squad 2. Mm-hmm. And from the sounds of things, it's going to have a much different look from the original
Suicide
Squad.
Lots of changes to this movie, apparently.
We talked, I believe, a couple weeks ago that about how Will Smith was exiting the film, mm-hmm. would not be returning. Well, according to our good friend reports, Idris Elba is the guy that Warner Brothers is aiming to get, and if you read between the lines, it sounds like pretty much has gotten to replace Will Smith as Deadshot in the Suicide Squad sequel. Nick, your thoughts on Idris Elba as Floyd Lawton?
Down for it. Idris Elba's outstanding in damn near everything. A little unfortunate that Will Smith's not returning because it is one of the few aspects of that film that really worked. But I can understand the need to make something of a clean break. I would be surprised if this has much, if anything, to do with the original film. I wouldn't even be surprised if they don't imply that this is a completely different and new version of Floyd Lawton altogether. We'll see.
We'll see. Also related to Suicide Squad 2, Joel Kinnaman is the guy that played the uncharismatic character Rick Flagg.
Mm-hmm.
And he will not appear in the upcoming sequel.
Oh, well.
According to current plans, this per Variety. I'm doubting, honestly, that James Gunn even has Rick Flagg in his script. I don't feel like Rick Flagg is an essential part of the Suicide Squad in the modern era. But I could be wrong on that. Some may disagree. Joel Kinnaman, any loss in your book?
No.
Fair enough. Now, let's talk about one of the weirder reports here, about the lineup.
I'm down for this. This sounds awesome. Because it's so bizarre.
Yes, it's purported to be in Gunn's script. Collider says that at least four new DC Comics characters will be joining the squad. First up is Ratcatcher, the character Otis Flanagan, a sewer-dwelling former exterminator who uses his ability to communicate with rats to commit crimes. Suicide Squad 2's version will be a woman who also has a penchant for poisons and a penchant for buggery.
Mm.
Then there's King Shark, who we know from the Flash TV show. He will be in the film. I'm not going to delve into all that because I don't know if that's even accurate. King Shark's
in the movie. Giant shark walks around, talks. Yep. Presumably, eats
next
people.
Up is one of Nick's favorite characters, Polka Dot Man, a minor Batman villain who, in the comic books, also went by Mr. Polka Dot.
I like that.
Who
better.
Has a costume covered in multicolored polka dots, which can be removed and turned to a variety of weapons. Suicide Squad 2 version powers reportedly cause polka dots to appear all over his body, leaving to his embarrassment in his own abilities. And then finally, there's Peacemaker. Yes. A pacifist extremist with the twisted belief that his own vigilante violence will lead to world peace. He's mostly unchanged in the film, and currently James Gunn is targeting Guardians of the Galaxy star Dave Bautista to play the Peacemaker.
Yes.
Bring it on, because I'm ready for it.
Yep. All of that sounds great.
And I didn't even know this. I probably did at some point, that Peacemaker was the inspiration for the comedian in Watchmen.
Hmm. Interesting.
Old Charlton character. Anyway. Moving on to... let's walk over here to this corner, Nick, if you can get there.
Weren't we already in the corner, though?
Yeah, we should have been, but we weren't. We were just sitting at the table.
We were looking at it.
We should have been in the DCEU corner. Mm-hmm. That's where we are now, folks. I'm sorry, Worlds of DCEU corner.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to the reports about Suicide Squad Dose, we also have a bit of news, PN news, about Black Adam, a movie that has seemingly been floating around for an eternity, right? In pre-production and just, you know, it's become one of those I'll believe it when I see it movies at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But a report came out that Hawkman, Stargirl, and Atom Smasher have featured roles in the latest draft of New Line Cinema's Black Adam film.
Mm-hmm.
That leads me to believe that the Justice Society could play a role in this movie, playing into Geoff Johns' run on JSA and Justice Society. According to that hashtag show, screenwriter Adam Zdeichel of Rampage reportedly turned in an updated draft in February. They will be looking for a 30-something actor to play Hawkman and two 20-something actors to play Stargirl and Atom Smasher. Now, two questions here that I think are pretty closely related to one another, Nick. What do you think about the inclusion of these characters? And do you think Black Adam ever happens?
I'm down for the inclusion of the characters, but at a certain point, if you're including these characters, is it really a Black Adam movie? You know, like, what are you going to do? Follow Black Adam as he does bad things, and we are supposed to cheer for him to defeat the heroes? Like, I don't...
I'm assuming that this will be part of, like, some sort of an anti-hero movie for Black Adam. Absolutely. Where he, you know, an origin anti-hero, and then perhaps ends with him joining, you know, hooking up with the Justice Society the way that he did in the Geoff Johns run. But maybe I'm wrong on that.
I don't know. Atom Smasher, I know nothing about. Stargirl, I'm down for. Hawkman, I'm down for. It would be cool, but I'm kind of like you. I think it is far more likely that we see The Rock as Black Adam in a Shazam sequel than it is that we see him in his own standalone movie first. And that perhaps appearing in a Shazam sequel could then actively get this Black Adam movie back on track. But, you know, it's been right in development for what feels like forever now. 4 years?
Yeah, it feels like it's been in development since The Rock was an active wrestler.
Yes.
So, let's move from DC Films, back as we center ourselves back at the table, onto the printed page. You know, that old thing, comic books that I used to read, and still should, but don't for some reason. Mm-hmm. Green Arrow, one of our favorite characters at DC. His title has been somewhat in limbo and somewhat in trouble for a while now. But a new Green Arrow title is planned, with DC planning to make the character, quote, a bigger part of the DCU, end quote, according to our boy, co-publisher Dan DiDio. DiDio revealed this when asked about March 6th's Green Arrow number 50, the final issue in the title's Rebirth Arrow volume launched in 2016. I feel like I said this a bunch of times, Nick, but I'm of two minds about this. Mm-hmm. I feel like I haven't been reading Green Arrow for a long time, so I don't want to be hypocritical in this. However, I feel like Green Arrow kind of carved out his own identity in Rebirth with the Ben Percy run and had his own had what seemed to be a pretty well-received thing going on there. And then they kind of deviated from that a little bit. I do think a fair criticism, though, is that since – not since Rebirth, but since the New 52, that Oliver Queen has felt like the odd man out in every major DC team and event.
I agree with that.
In other words
– he had a prominent role in Justice League of America, though, which led into Forever Evil.
True, but that was a limited run comic too.
True.
And he felt like he was left out of the main Justice League book for the outside of one little arc. Mm-hmm. Didn't really play a factor in any of the major DC events. In Rebirth, he was pretty much a non-factor outside of his own book. He didn't play really a major role seemingly in the Rebirth events.
I agree with the basic point that you're making.
However, I don't want to see him more fully integrated
into a DCU that is being overseen by the ideas of Dan DiDio at this point.
Right.
Yes.
I don't want to see Oliver Queen's life and status in the DCU, but both made – in other words, as we've seen with Wally West recently – just because your status is returned and just because your importance in the universe is made greater isn't necessarily a good thing for a character, or doesn't necessarily turn into a good thing for a character. We've seen this with Dick Grayson, another great example. Dick Grayson's certainly a prominent part of the DCU right now. I would argue that's not a good thing in this case. Mm-hmm. And I think that we don't know what's going to happen with Oliver Queen, but seemingly he's been in, if you look in terms of the storylines, he's been an outsider to the Justice League for years now. And now he's apparently going, he's doing this bad thing involving some box that the Martian Manhunter gave him. And his actions are going to drive everyone close to him away, which I feel like, again, we've seen that story play out a million times. And I don't know. I'm not confident either, Nick, with the future of our boy Ollie.
Nope. Not at all. My Danny DeO pessimism is nothing but repetitive at this point. So any quote new direction or re-emphasis on anything in the DCU at this point is probably going to be met with negativity from me, because that's just where I'm at as it relates to the state of DC Comics right now.
Well, one good thing that DC did was they let Mark Russell and Richard Pace retain the rights to their DC Vertigo title, Second Coming. A little bit of a follow-up to that story. It has found a new publishing home with Ahoy Comics, according to the New York Times. Pace and Russell have signed a deal with Ahoy, whose editorial team includes several former DC editors. Mm. So, Nick, happy ending of sorts to the to a story that we talked about here on the show a few weeks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a little surprised that Image didn't jump all over this. It just seemed like a perfect fit from a tone standpoint. But if this Ahoy group has some familiarity based on former DC staffers with Russell and the book, could make a lot of sense. Never heard of this company before, so hopefully it works out for them and they can get some decent distribution and a digital platform, whether it be Comixology Unlimited or some sort of deal there.
Some sort of deal there, indeed. Well, that's the end of the rundown. And that can only mean that it's time for that portion of the show where we talk about what we've been reading and watching.
Mm-hmm.
The segment known the world over. Women, children, men, animals, the world over know it as reading and watching.
Mm-hmm.
Reading and watching what you been reading and watching.
What you been reading and watching.
So, Nick, what you been reading?
No comment.
No comment.
I plead the fifth.
You played a fifth of Jack. Mm. Anyway, I took a needed break from reading this week because we've done two long book hunters in a row. I thought, you know, give myself a little break here, a little break of Rooney.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been watching stuff.
Mm.
Have you?
Yeah. So we didn't do a reading and watching last week. So we actually have one episode of Supergirl that I watched, and then an episode of Arrow for this week. So,
well, let's talk about that episode of Supergirl that you watched.
Whatever Happened to Truth, Justice, and the American Way, or What's So Fine? I don't remember the title of the episode. It was the Manchester Black and the Elite episode where they introduced
What's So Funny About Truth, Justice, and the American Way, probably. Sure. Comic.
Whatever you say. It's not important. It was a decent episode. Moves forward the Lockwood stuff, interestingly enough. And kind of sets up the dynamic, I think, what's going to play out over the rest of the season of Supergirl kind of being caught in the middle of these two violently opposed ideologies and factions. So, interesting that they are going to now have, you know, they've had the Agents of Liberty as this villainous force throughout the season, but now they're going to have this force that you would think just by being opposed to them is more heroic or noble in nature, but it's really not. It's kind of showing you how the point seems to be that extremism in any form is ultimately not good for the world. So I dug the episode. I'm interested to get your thoughts when you get a chance to see it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've enjoyed the season for Supergirl as it's progressed. I just need to catch up at some point. And gosh, do we have 2 weeks of Arrow to talk about?
No, one.
One. Okay, 1 week of Arrow to talk about, and God help me, I'm struggling to remember what that episode was.
I believe it was called Brothers and Sisters, if I'm remembering correctly.
Brothers and Sisters. And this was the episode that featured the new Suicide Squad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Led by Ricardo Diaz.
Mm-hmm.
Also featured Oliver and Emiko working together, him trying to earn her trust, seemingly. And also featured this is probably the biggest, there's a lot that happened in this episode, honestly. This is a very eventful episode. Include the flash forwards as well. And also featured the on-screen debut of the character Dante,
mm-hmm.
who is played by Adrian Paul, a.k.a. Duncan MacLeod, the TV Highlander. And holy mackerel, for his age, that dude can still move. His fight scene with Green Arrow in this episode was fantastic. And he came off like a total badass to the point where it felt like he could have beaten Ollie in their encounter, which is no small feat in the Arrowverse, with his standing in the hand-to-hand rankings, I guess if you would say. So Dante is instantly an intimidating villain, and one that Adrian Paul's a good actor who plays him with panache. All of the stuff at the new Suicide Squad was good. Diggle and Lila, their situation at Argus kind of gets resolved a little bit as Diggle has a reason to just return to Star City. And we get a pretty major development in the worlds of both Alicity and Oliver's relationship with his sister, Emiko. So Felicity finally tells Oliver that she's pregnant. I thought this was a great moment, Nick. One of my favorite moments of the season to this point. Really a touching moment between them. Felicity gets some needed closure on the Diaz arc. Diaz himself gets closure in a pretty major way. This was a very strong episode, I thought, Nick. I really enjoyed it. One of the most eventful episodes in a while, it felt like.
Yeah, I dug it as well, especially the flash-forward stuff where we get a little bit of the dynamic between the revealed Mia Smoke and William, kind of getting that dynamic there. As you mentioned, the Suicide Squad or Ghost, what do they call it? What are they calling on the show now? Ghost.
I've forgotten.
Ghost something or the other. I don't know.
Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol, yeah. No, all good stuff. Arrow continues to have some momentum here, so enjoying it.
Yep. And Tuesday, which you haven't seen The Flash yet, so.
I'm not.
We should not discuss that. So we won't. And that'll bring an end to reading and watching. Actually, I did want to talk about playing, something that I played while I was down there on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I got to play a couple of cool arcade games, one of which was the Batman arcade game that we've talked about a time or two, perhaps, in passing on the show, where you get to play as a different Batmobiles, and I, as I always do, picked the 89 Batmobile to play as, and did not do well, but enjoyed it nonetheless. I did not progress very far into the game, but enjoyed playing through it. They also had the Injustice arcade game, which I'll be honest, Nick, I did not know existed.
Yes.
Are you aware of this?
Vaguely, yes. I believe it's very similar to the mobile game.
It actually gives you cards. The game actually gives you like trading cards of based on if you know, assuming that you win your matchup, obviously. And the weird thing is you seemingly didn't have control of who you picked on your team. Like it randomly assigns you like two teams to pick from, I think, if I'm remembering this game correctly. And I picked one that had like Sinestro and a few other people on it. Then once you win, it randomly gives you a trading card. And it's got this whole list of trading cards on a giant billboard next to the arcade that shows you all the ones they had. I got pretty randomly, a Deathstroke from Arkham Origins card that I got from the game. Played that. It was fun. I'm trying to think of the other comic book related games that I might have played. Oh, yes. Probably my favorite one of the traditional arcade games that I played while I was there was actually a Walking Dead arcade game that they had at Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville. And it was a Walking Dead arcade game where it's potentially two player. I played it by myself. And you get into a sort of a seated position. in this little booth thing, and you're armed with a crossbow. And the premise of the game is that you you take over somebody that is in a prison, similar to season two of the television – or season three of the television series. And you're in this prison, and you're with a woman beside you, and – or if you're the woman, you're with the guy. And you're basically the zombies, the walkers, have broken into the prison, and you're trying to escape this prison with your friends. And the thing that makes this game fun is it really sticks to Walking Dead canon, which is that only headshots matter. And that makes it both really fun and really, really challenging, but not in a way that felt like a lot of arcade games where it's like a forced challenge, where it's like the computer is just so hard that nobody could possibly beat it because they want more money from you. It was a game where if I had been better, I feel like I could have cleared it a lot quicker than I did, a lot easier than I did. But it was really fun, man. I thought it was a really cool dynamic, having to aim for the head, being unforgiving with your ammo, having to watch, you know, your ammo very closely. It was super fun. I'd recommend anybody that finds that Walking Dead arcade game to play it.
Interesting.
And that is it. That brings an end to that segment. And you know, I'm looking at the compass, the traditional compass that I have now built into my floor here on my side of the studio, and it's pointing me towards the grandfather clock that is now suspended above the wall, hanging. And this grandfather clock shows me, Nick, that there's about a minute on it. And that can only mean that it's time for the wrestling minute. Nick, wrestling minute.
Yeah.
What's going on?
We had, of course, the WWE Fastlane pay-per-view, which is very important. I mean, there's always a great justification for having two whole pay-per-views in between the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. Not overkill or detrimental to the WrestleMania build at all. Decent show. I enjoyed it. I thought pretty much everything on it was good to very good. And then we had a very lackluster episode of Monday Night Raw that followed up on it. So you take the good, you take them bad, and they take the bad, and there you there you go. Messed that up.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yes, I very much enjoyed Fastlane. Thought it was a very good show. Raw, up and down. Good stuff at the end with Drew McIntyre, and a pretty poor Triple H and Batista segment are the main things I remember from Raw. Oh, and a good Ronda Rousey segment.
There you go.
Are the main things I remember from Raw. Neither one of us watched SmackDown yet. So that is the wrestling minute. Oh, and we are making plans to go to WrestleMania and potentially making plans to go to a little All Elite Wrestling, Nick.
Yeah, we have it.
Might be all in.
Yeah, you know, this is odd. You and I haven't really spoken to each other as much as we normally do in the last like 2 weeks, so we actually need to talk about that at some point. You know, lots of plans that need to be discussed.
And miles to go before we sleep.
But it's interesting, Greg, that you bring up All Elite Wrestling, because we're gonna end the show here as we do every week now, with the new tradition of WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross singing us a little song on his way out the door. And, you know, I guess it's technically tied to the wrestling as well. Some reports, Mr. Ross, have started to surface online that you are going to be leaving WWE when your contract is up at the end of, I believe it's March, at the end of this month. And
reports.
And already a widespread speculation that you will be signing a long-term, reportedly a multi-million dollar deal with AEW, in excess of $1 million annually, long-term, to be involved with the company. And a lot of people believe we'll be seeing you in Las Vegas for the Double or Nothing event at the end of May. Would you care to comment?
Well, first of all, yes, I would like to comment. First of all, don't believe everything you read on the internet, okay? That's number one. Just because you read some Richard out there that thinks they have all the answers, thinks they know everything about this business, it doesn't mean it's right. Doesn't mean it's true. And even if it turns out that it is true and it is right, then I have been offered a very generous sum of money, $1 million American, a fair, decent reward for somebody of my stature and years of experience in the business. Even if that is true, it doesn't mean that it was right to report it on the internet. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I think that's fair to say. Now, whether I am or am not going to be in Las Vegas, when it comes time for all, you know, all in, T, whatever you want to call it,
double or nothing.
Whatever they're calling this event, whether I'm going to be there or not, there's one song that has always stood out to me in the great song sung by the King Elvis Presley. You're familiar with Elvis Presley, Mr. Duke?
I am. I'm a rather big fan of his.
Well, Mr. Presley did a song sometime in the early 70s when I was just getting started in this business, riding the roads with Dan Hodge and some of my fraternity brothers.
You sure that was the early 70s, JR?
It might have been the late 60s. Sometime when I was probably a little bit in a haze. I'll be frank with you. I like to have some of that whacky tobacco back in the day.
What are your thoughts on Ann Margaret, JR?
High cheekbones, quite frankly. I liked Ann Margaret. I like the hyphenation in her name. Ann Margaret. Good name. But one word that I like, one song rather that I like to sing, might have been the early 60s even, now that I think about it. A little song that goes a little something like this. Well, Bright Light City, gonna set my soul, for God's sake. Gonna set my soul on fire. Just like Cain did that one time. Got a whole lot of money that is ready to burn. $1 million American, quite frankly. So get those stakes up higher. There are 1,000 pretty women waiting out there, and they're all living. Devil may care. Well, I'm just a devil with love to spare, quite frankly. Viva Las Vegas. Viva Las Vegas. Get the point, folks? How I wish that there were more than 24 hours in the day. Because even if there were 40 more, quite frankly, first of all, I'd go to work and I'd get the job done. I wouldn't complain about it. But also, I wouldn't sleep a single minute away. I would work on my trade. Oh, there's blackjack and there's poker and a roulette wheel. A fortune won and lost on every deal. All you need is a strong heart and a nervous steel. Viva Las Vegas, quite frankly. Viva Las Vegas. Viva Las Vegas with your neon flashing and your one-armed bandits crashing. All those hopes down the toilet drain. You know what also got shoved down the toilet drain one time was a turd the size of my forehead. It was Brian Pillman. I'll never forget as long as I live. We were in some building somewhere in Ohio, I think, and Brian Pillman called me into the bathroom, and he pointed down. He said, "Look at this, JR, look at this." And I said, "What are you calling me in here for, Scooter? I mean Pillman." And I walked in there, and I looked at that toilet, and by God, it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life. You didn't even want to flush it. It was so impressive. Viva Las Vegas, turning day into nighttime, turning night into daytime. If you see it once, you'll never be the same again. I'm going to keep on the run. I'm going to have me some fun if it costs me my very last dime. If I wind up broke, well, that's not going to be the fault of the business. That is going to be my own fault for my personal choices that I made along the way. I'll always remember that I had a swinging time. I'm going to give it everything I've got. Lady Luck, please let the dice stay hot. Let me shout a 7 with every shot. Viva Las Vegas, Viva Las Vegas, double or nothing, Viva, Viva, double or nothing, Las Vegas.